Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, as a native Floridian, I subscribe to the magazine of the Florida Humanities Council, and every year they give awards to writers and filmmakers. In 2015, my guest's novel, The Sheltering, was awarded the Bronze Medal in Fiction. You know, reading the description of it, it sounded intriguing to me, and his publisher sent me a copy, and I read it, and I was blown away. It's that good. The author is Mark Powell, and he's my guest this week on American Variety. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, thank you for having me, Claude. It's a pleasure.
Good to have you on. Mark is joining us from Boone, North Carolina, where he's just taken a new position teaching creative writing at Appalachian State University. And he came before that from Stetson University in Florida. The novel, The Sheltering, is basically two storylines of different sets of characters that eventually merge. So why don't you just start off by telling us the basic plot line, Mark?
Right, absolutely. So, Court, it's set just after the financial collapse of 2007-2008 and in the midst of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars. It follows, as you say, two plot lines. One is the family of a drone pilot who dies in an automobile accident that may or may not be suicide. The other is the story of two brothers. One has just returned from the military. He's been discharged from the military after numerous tours abroad. The other, the younger brother, has just been released from prison, and they wind up on a road trip that entangles both of the families in some not terribly pleasant ways.
Yeah, it's pretty dark in many ways. I mean, I'm no literary critic or intellectual, so I don't know all that much about genres of literature, but I think I'd describe this as a novel of something like postmodern existential despair. I mean, it's gritty. It's very real. It kind of reminds you of, in a way, not as heavy as The Road by Cormac McCarthy, but something along those lines. You know, it's very real, and most of the characters seem to be driving toward falling off a cliff, and a lot of them do, kind of. So what would you call it as far as genre? Is that more or less in the ballpark?
I think postmodern existential dread is a pretty fair take. I also hope it's just an honest look at certain segments of American culture.
Well, I think it is. You know, I think it is, and it's startling. I mean, I'm thinking about you as I guess you're about 40, you know, a family man, a professor at a university, and you're around students, I realize, but kind of the in talk of teenage, late teenage, college age people and then young people, you know, a couple of whom are kind of sort of outlaws on the run in a way, is very, very realistic seeming to me. And I've only kind of touched some of those areas of American life myself, you know, in my own life. And it's very contemporary, too. I mean, it's just like written yesterday or last year anyway or something, right? So that's pretty impressive. Some of the book jacket reviews or other reviews I've seen of it describe one of the characters, the younger brother Donnie of the, again, two sets of characters, and one is basically two brothers and their wives and ex-wives and families and kids, describes Donnie as a psychopath. Would you describe him that way? I wouldn't.
I don't know clinically if he would be diagnosed as a psychopath or a sociopath or anything like that. To me, he's someone who is, you know, like Dr. King said, maladjusted. He has looked at the sort of gross sickness of culture. He's experienced violence. He's partaken in violence. And he's not going to play that very American game of fitting in, of wearing that facade. And that puts him outside of culture, right? He becomes an outlier because of his refusal to be co-opted or to be coerced or however you want to put it. Is he a sociopath? I didn't think of him like that. He certainly has a violent and mean streak. I feel more like he's a seeker, a seeker whose quest has in many ways gone wrong, but a seeker nonetheless.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I took it. I mean, I think he's very empathetic, which sociopaths and psychopaths are not. He's able to really feel what other people are feeling almost to a heightened degree. Like you said, he's just hell-bent and prone to violence. Yeah. And he's a type that I think used to be more common 100 years ago, the guy in a bar looking for a fight or whatever, but is rare today, and they're usually in jail when they are around, you know, so we've kind of suppressed that type. But it used to be one of the American types, and it's no longer that way, and he's just kind of a man out of place. And his older brother, Bobby, who's the other kind of pair of that side of the book, is more civilized, even though he's been in Iraq and a couple of tours or whatever. So both sets of characters actually have been affected by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And on the other side of the other family, the father, Luther Redding, has had to take a job. He's come back, and he and his wife became briefly millionaires in the Florida real estate boom, and then when it popped, so did they, right? So he had to take a job as a drone operator and is tormented by his daily work of stalking and killing, and On the other hand, the older brother, Bobby, that I just mentioned, is haunted by a young boy he shot dead in Sadr City, Iraq, when he thought the boy had fired an RPG. So obviously the wars have had a big impact on the personal and family life back in the States in this book, and I think in real life too, you know, so that's another way that it connects so much with reality. Do you see that kind of collateral damage impact a lot?
I do, and it's kind of stunning, Court, the extent to which we both experience it and fail to experience it. So I went to, my undergraduate degree is from the Citadel, which is a small military college in Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And most of my friends went into the military. You know, they were serving, they were doing their four-year hitches when September 11th happened. Most of them wound up staying in for many more years, in many cases stop-lost, unable to leave. I was not. I was a graduate student. I was trying to teach myself to write. I was married. I was starting a very different life. But of course, I was sort of following them, watching them deploy again and again, watching the fallout of, you know, of the result of this, these extended leaves, this movement between an incredibly violent world and then trying to, you know, reintegrate into what we would call maybe normal life in the United States. Yeah. So there's that side of it. You know, the great deal of collateral damage that is psychic, you know, that sort of permeates the soul, I think.
Sure.
And then there's the incredible extent to which we are not at all affected by these wars, or at least a tiny percentage of it is. I think the reason I became so fascinated with drones seem the perfect metaphor for our society, right? We of course imagine it. You can fly these things literally from the opposite side of the planet. You can be in a combat zone sitting in front of a console in MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, which is where Luther Redding is operating. And you can be killing someone on the other side of the planet. It's that sort of disjunction. I think there's a comment early in the book that the soul's not made for that, right? That sort of separation, it corrodes. But the idea that we live by proxy to some extent is frightening. And it's very true to great extents. In the United States and in much of the Western world, we have people who do things for us. Particularly, we have people who do nasty things on our behalf.
Right.
And there's a part of me, of course, that is very grateful for that. And there's a part of me that's really frightened by what that has done to us and is going to continue to do to us in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about that, you know, from the beginning of the war on terror, you know, after 9/11, when, you know, before we got drones going into play, but when it was largely an air war, you know, so we'd hit an apartment block in the Gaza Strip in the middle of the night with a 500-pound bomb and kill, you know, everybody in there to get one guy who may or may not be there, you know, and the whole thing is detached, like you say, and then that almost seems unnatural, as you said, and it's almost unfair to conduct war that way because, you know, we're kind of evolved to conduct hand-to-hand combat where the strongest guy or the smartest guy or the quickest guy will win, and now it's the one with the greatest technology, and you can sit, as you say, you know, half a world away and coolly and calmly kill people. But I have read about PTSD in drone operators because the psychological stress of doing that is so hard and bizarre and unusual, it doesn't fit our evolution as biological beings. And so that's part of the underlayment of your story. And, you know, it kind of goes along with social media and everything else. There are so many things that detach us from ourselves and from other people now. And it's just a major one for those people who are involved in the war and for their families, you know, and that's the collateral damage part of it comes in when people are coming back and forth and from, you know, wars where they're trained to be, if they're on the ground, they're trained to be basically an attack dog killer. And then they come back and they're supposed to be a nice, calm, civilian, civilized, polite person.
Right.
It's just not, you know, it just ain't natural.
No, it's not. And it's interesting you raise the question of, or the issue of PTSD and drone operators. This book came actually from an encounter with a drone operator. I was at a writing conference in St. Augustine, Florida, several years ago. And a friend was there and he was staying and we were down in the common room. It was very late at night and there was a gentleman on the couch and he was clearly deep in his cups. He was very, very drunk. And he was muttering and and the drunker he got, the more he began to mutter. And I began to realize after a while, either he was a drone operator or he knew enough about it to really fool me. And as I did research, I realized that he had access to information that I don't think the average person would have. Hmm. Eventually, he sort of passed down. And as my friend and I were leaving, my friend said something to me that really stuck. He said, I would hate to be privy to his inner life.
Really?
And you know, I spent years, Court, thinking about that man's inner life. What is it like, or what was it like, to work to fly a drone for 12 hours? possibly kill someone, and then drive your car home through the evening rush hour traffic to help your children with their homework. And that's where the book came from. It came from me trying to conjure what that inner life is like.
Yeah, it's unnatural. I guess that's the only simple word for it, and it's bizarre. So another theme, kind of a background theme that propels people in your book is the Great Recession, especially, as I mentioned, you know, the real estate collapse in Florida in 2007 and after, and the Redding family had briefly been, you know, it was kind of a joke in the book, they were slightly over $1 million in their bank account, you know, like $1,026,000 or something, you know, before the music stopped and they were left, like a lot of people, without a musical chair, right? Mm-hmm. So the economic freefall really jarred their whole family, and again, a kind of a collateral damage. It was kind of an explosion in their nuclear family. Right. And is that kind of dislocation still common in Florida today that you see from having lived down there in DeLand in the middle of the state for years?
I don't think it's as common, but certainly, you know, Florida in all ways strikes me as a sort of casino, particularly the real estate market. My wife and I, we moved there in 2008, and it looked as if we had hit the bottom in the real estate market and the chaos of things. And then, of course, we hadn't. You know, there was a further collapse late in 2008. So we were just arriving, and we were meeting people, and we were meeting them at going away parties. We were meeting them, in some cases, at foreclosure parties where people were moving out of their houses. Mm. And it was stunning. And I was reminded of a line the great Robert Stone used once in a short story. They were living their lives as if the check would never come due. And of course, in 2008, and in so many ways, in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the check for the American century, or, you know, whatever it is, the check came due. And that was the sense of things. And it was kind of stunning. It was stunning. I had the feeling at one point looking around Florida, there wasn't a responsible adult to be found, regardless of age. No one quite knew what to make of this.
You know, it's funny. I'm a third generation Floridian, third generation Miamian, actually, which takes me back to, I think my grandparents on one side first arrived there, and the population was like 2,000. And so in my family, there's a long history of experiencing these ups and downs in the jagged Florida real estate market, apart from any national, you know, collapses and ups and downs. And so it's a separate thing entirely, because Florida used to run on agriculture and oranges and so on, but also mainly now on tourism and building construction, you know, to accommodate retirees coming in and that kind of thing. So, you know, my family's used to that, and I was watching this one as just another cycle like that, and it was obvious to me it was going to pop, you know, at some point, but sure. Your description of parties, like foreclosure parties, I mean, that's bizarre. There's an Irish wake on the one hand when somebody's died, but it ain't you who's died, you know? In this
exactly,
case, the people who have died are at the party, you know, that's kind of a bizarre thing. I mean, I'm hearing cicadas on your end. I guess we're hearing the nature of North Carolina, which, you know, maybe fits the show somewhat, I don't know, that's good.
We are indeed. They're in the trees here around me.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, by the way, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Mark Powell, who is the author of a novel called The Sheltering. That's an award-winning novel about a couple of families in Florida that lead some kind of extreme lives, and some dramatic things happen to them, and they end up being kind of intertwined. And really, Mark, all the characters in the book are very strongly drawn. They're very powerful, clear characters. I mean, I had a very clear image in my mind of what they all look like. It might be very different from what somebody else's image of what they look like might be. But the dialogue, as I mentioned, is so real. And you know, again, you're a family man, a guy with kids and a wife and around 40. How did you get the dialogue of teenagers and people on the edge of the law so well?
Well, thank you for saying that. That's very kind of you. You know, I try, Court, to just do what I think the essential job of any writer is, and that's just to pay attention as much as possible. I listen to my students. You know, I'm lucky enough to be working more or less every day with young people. I taught for 3 years in a prison system.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, you try to listen. You try to get those cadences. You try to get those concerns. And then you try to, you know, think of the commonalities that exist between these different audiences. Young people, I think, and people in prisons are to some degree, rightly or wrongly, feel like they're marginalized, and they want to be taken seriously. They want to be heard. They want someone to listen to them. So as much as possible, I just try to sit back and absorb these voices, absorb these concerns. I do find that when I use the slang of young people or the prison slang, by the time I get it on the page, it's actually, it's obsolescent. It's passed on. There's something new, but there's not much one can do about that.
Yeah, but the catch is most of your readers don't know that, because they're even farther behind than you are. You're much closer to it than they are. I did wonder as I read this, and, you know, the the majority of the people who have the biggest roles in the book are fairly young, their late teens and through their 20s. And are young Americans really as decadent and lost, do you think, as those you portray in the book? Is it different from past alienated young generations in the 20s and the 60s? I mean, is it more permanent, more irreversible? I mean, are they that lost, or was it, you know, dramatic license to some extent, and you were picking people?
Right. Now, well, it's interesting, Court, because, of course, the Plato was complaining about the younger generations, you know, 2,000 and however many years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think they're more lost than we had generations prior to this. I think there are particular tools now that make their lostness more difficult to overcome.
Right.
I think there's a corrosive effect social media has on young lives. I have students who, they'll spend a week logging their use of Facebook, and then they'll spend a week trying to go cold turkey. And inevitably what they talk about is their sense of not only being out of the loop, but what's happening to their online reputations, right? They're trapped by the sort of social world. I think of the stupid things I did when I was 16 and 17 and 18, and I'm so thankful that most people have forgotten them and I can engage in some sort of strategic forgetting. Young people don't have that benefit anymore. Everything is online. It's filmed. It's posted. It's on Instagram. It's on Twitter. It's somewhere. I think that's dangerous. How do you grow? How do you reinvent yourself? How do you become the person you're going to be when this old self or all of these old selves follow behind you? It's troubling. And I think that is maybe the particular difference that strikes me between previous generations and this generation.
Yeah, that's a big one. And, you know, I think the kind of dissolution, or at least the erosion of the family, is a big factor. I mean, I remember, you know, being a kid in the 50s, and even, you know, if the parents of my friends weren't getting along that well, it was not apparent. I mean, everything seemed pretty coherent and cohesive to me, and it wasn't this kind of crazy, you know, just wild divorce and, you know, single parenthood and everything. You know, it wasn't, all of that was just not really in the picture. Another thing is drugs. I mean, people used to get drunk, but the kind of drugs that one group of the people in your book are taking really affect your brain. I mean, you know, and they affect your behavior in massive ways, where you end up killing somebody, whereas if you're drunk, you probably wouldn't have, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So those are differences.
Yeah. You know, we once had these bulwarks against this sort of thing. We had families, we had churches, we had community institutions. I don't see a lot of that anymore. And you're right, you know, I have students who are far more likely to be taking prescription drugs on a Friday or Saturday night than they are to be drinking alcohol.
So we sound like a couple of geezers talking about, you know, complaining about the young generation. And, you're a younger generation than I am. But, I mean, the stuff we're talking about, I think, is true, even taking a long view of it. I think it's a different, more intense dislocation and alienation than used to exist among younger generations. So we'll hope we'll survive it, and, you know, our society will stumble on here.
Right.
But you mentioned you went to the Citadel, which is a very intense place, and then the University of South Carolina, and then Yale Divinity School. And, of course, then you taught at universities and at a prison. I mean, so you've been in a lot of very different environments yourself. I mean, that's a real span of cultures that more than a greater span than most people are exposed to in their lives. Aren't you in kind of a permanent culture shock, or have you internalized all of that?
Well, it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me alert, right? It's what makes life interesting, moving between those things. And then you start to recognize these sort of real commonalities. There are a few educational institutions that could be more different than the Citadel and Yale Divinity School, which is a very, you know, progressive, liberal seminary. But in both cases, the schools are filled with people, I think, who are searching for some sort of larger purpose. In a way, I'm not sure you always find at other places, other colleges and universities. There are people very much who want to figure out, how do I fit in the world, and what is it I'm supposed to do here beyond self-enrichment? And I think that's the reason I was drawn to both of those. The approaches, of course, are very different. Most of my friends at the Citadel went on to join the military. My closest friends at Yale were pacifist, and not armchair pacifist either. They were people who were going out, you know, working in conflict zones all over the world as aid workers or human shields or all of these things. But there was this basic desire in both groups to do something that matters. And of course, I sit here in between them as the sort of quiet voyeur trying to soak up as much of this as I possibly can for mostly the narcissistic, selfish means of writing about it, I should say. but that's what the writer does.
Yeah, I'd say the Citadel, I mean, thinking about it, the Citadel and Yale Divinity, you know, one of those commonalities, and you kind of touched on it, is maybe an idealism, you know, like you said, a seeking, and that's another way of saying it, but, you know, really an idealism, you know, a way of attaching to something greater than yourself, whether it be nationalistic fervor, you know, and the kind of nobility and glory of warfare in a way that used to be anyway, but, or the religious spiritual side of it, you know, so maybe there's that. Maybe you're just really fundamentally an idealist, and that makes you a writer too.
Part of, I think, what makes me a writer is that all of those seemingly antiquated, you know, notions of being American, of freedom and justice for all, a large part of me is very cynical. A large part of me still believes very deeply in these and is continually appalled at our sort of failure to embody them. That tension's maybe not a bad place to be, though.
Yeah. So you're always striving to attain some ideal, and that drives you, you know, so that's a good thing. Anyway, but you are described everywhere as an Appalachian regional writer, and that may be where you came from, which is more in the Carolina Mountains or whatever. But I think in this case of this novel, The Sheltering, I think it's a gross understatement. And in general, I think maybe what I see of you as a writer, that's a real kind of limiting understatement. And The Sheltering isn't Appalachian at all. And although much of it takes place in Florida, it's not even regional. But it's your fourth novel, and I gather the first three novels are set in the Southern Appalachians. They were published, in fact, by the University of Tennessee Press. Yeah. Why don't you tell us just very briefly, Mark, about those three?
Okay, the first one is set northwestern South Carolina, where I grew up, and it's set during the Second World War, and it's more or less about a life on the home front during the war. The second one is set in 1970, and it's about three brothers, one has been in Korea, one has been in Vietnam, and they have all sort of returned home, and they're trying to make a life there. The third one is set in the same area. They're all three set in northwestern South Carolina, western North Carolina. And it is during the 2008 presidential election. My wife and I, I just finished up Yale Divinity, and we were passing from Connecticut to Florida, and we wound up spending a summer there. And this is just after Barack Obama had won the primary there in South Carolina and was starting sort of to move to the, you know, to the front of the Democratic field. And I got there and I was seeing people that I knew I hadn't seen since I was young. And we would start talking about politics and I was finding myself in total agreement. They would be saying that, you know, government is not responsive to the needs of citizens. We are living effectively in an oligarchy, and I'm nodding my head in agreement. And then all of a sudden they would say, and you know, this guy Obama is building concentration camps. Okay. And I would say, wait, what? What
right.
just happened?
Right.
Right. You know, we just went off the rails somewhere. There was an explosion of extremist groups that happened around 2008, 2009. And I was just fascinated by this. So the book is about an extremist group in the mountains there of North Carolina. As I talked to these people, I realized, though their ideas were crazy, they weren't fools. They had been culturally and economically marginalized, and this was the way in which they reacted. They reacted, and it's crazy, no doubt. But it was a crazy that made me curious about what was happening in the United States. That was the point, 2008, that I really saw these, and that's what my third novel is about. It's called The Dark Corner.
So, Mark, why don't you just rattle off the names of those three novels in order? The listeners will try to remember which one's which. The earlier first one's like right after World War II, and it's kind of around the Asheville area. So go ahead from there.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it moves up to Asheville. It's called Prodigals.
Okay.
The second is set in 1970, and it's called Blood Kin. The third is set in 2008, and it's called The Dark Corner.
Okay. Mark Powell is the author, and you got the names. And the University of Tennessee Press, I'm sure they're available on Amazon. Like The Sheltering would be. So when I first read about you, Mark, I thought you sounded like, your description of you that I read sounded like Pat Conroy, who's the author of The Prince of Tides and other great novels, one of which was The Lords of Discipline, set at the Citadel, where he also went to school.
Right.
Then I saw when I got the book that he had written a very lengthy and admiring foreword of your book. I mean, it reads like a New York Times book review. It's like, you know, several pages long, not the usual one-page foreword. And I see that Pat Conroy, I hadn't realized it, just passed away in March 2016.
Yes.
Did you know him?
I did. I got to know him in the last few years of his life, and he was as great a writer as Pat was. He was an even more generous and kind person. He was really an amazing man. I had met him once as a graduate student when he came to Reed, but I didn't get to know him until South Carolina took the sheltering. I had heard that they were looking for books with South Carolina connections. I just finished this book, so I contacted them, and you know, they took the book, and I started corresponding then with Pat, and I met him just before the book came out, or just, I guess, as the book came out. And he was just so incredibly kind, so incredibly generous. I went to the Citadel because as a high school junior, I had read The Lords of Discipline, and it had triggered some sort of, I don't know, sick impulse in my brain to see if I could make it there too. And when I was a nob there, a first year student, my now wife, who was a high school senior, read The Lords of Discipline and wrote me a letter in which she feared that I had become mean in such a place. And of course, if there's ever anything in life that's kept me from being mean, I think it was getting that letter. It was sort of before we even knew Pat, the human being, we knew Pat on the page, and it was what initially brought us together. So when I met him, it was so wonderful to get him to, you know, to tell him that he'd had this influence the last 15 years of our lives without ever knowing us. And I know he had that influence on thousands of people. So I got to meet him. I got to know him. He had his 70th birthday party the fall of 2015. And it was just after that, of course, that he found out he was very ill, and he passed away in the spring. But I'm really grateful for that period of time. I'm so, so glad that I got to know the man.
Yeah, it's a good story. I'm glad you got to meet him, too. So, Mark, we just have a minute or so left, and this is a big question to try to answer in 25 words or less, or at least 30 seconds or so, but where do you see our society going? I mean, your book is kind of dark, and are we spiraling out of control as the characters in your book were?
Oh, Court, I worry. I have a pessimistic view of the future. I'm extremely worried about things like climate change and what's happening as we fall deeper into technology and become sort of estranged from our lives. But that said, I get up every day happy and grateful, and I love being with my children, and I love life. So maybe I'm living in that human contradiction of pessimistic view of the future, but pretty happy in the moment.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the way many sane and intelligent adults have lived since the invention of really great mass weapons of destruction and so on. But so anyway, leaving that, so where can people buy your books, and in particular the last one, The Sheltering? I'm sure they're all available on Amazon, but can they go to University of South Carolina Press and get them?
Absolutely, or you could order them through your local bookstore. They're probably not on the shelves anymore, but I'm sure they'd be happy to order them for you.
Okay, good. Well, I heartily recommend The Sheltering. I haven't read the others, but I'm going to get a couple of them and read them, especially the first one that's taking place in Western North Carolina around Asheville. Sounds good, because I spent some time in Asheville. Well, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety, Mark.
That was my pleasure, Court. Thank you for having me.
Yep, our pleasure too, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.